For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
So, for those of you who are just coming, this just came for the talk period in the talk. Some of us are engaged in a half-day session today, so maybe you feel a little bit of different quality. I don't know, but just a half-day sitting. We're just sitting 5 or 6 periods of zazen this morning and chanting a little bit later. We're going to chant the Jiju Zammai. So I thought I'd talk about that a little bit, and a couple of other things. Just got a couple quotes that I'm going to try and weave together. The first one of which is from a Japanese Zen master from the 19th century, Soto Zen priest, teacher, scholar, named Nishiari Bokusan. And he has a direct relationship with our lineage. I'm not sure. Yeah, I think he's a direct descendant of ours. But he was the teacher of one of our teacher's teachers. So Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, maybe some of you have heard of him. He was the Japanese teacher who brought this tradition to San Francisco in the 1950s and founded San Francisco Zen Center and Tassajara Zen Monastery. I find it's kind of nice to sometimes have this background if we don't know a lot about our tradition. You don't need it. It's enough. The main thing is just to come and sit. And that's mainly what I'm going to be talking about. But I find it's interesting and helpful sometimes to have a little of the historical and cultural background. So Shunryu Suzuki came in the 1950s. His first teacher was actually his father. I think he was ordained by his father, and then he was sent off to study with an uncle, and then I think he had another teacher. And this other teacher, their teacher was Nishiari Bokusan. And the comment, I've been reading some of Nishiari Bokusan's commentary on Dogen, the founder of our tradition in Japan in the 12th century, 13th century. Sort of leading up to that, they said that you could, if you listen for it in Suzuki Roshi's teachings, you actually see the direct influence of Nishiari Roshi on Suzuki Roshi. So this is a quote. It's just a small passage, but it really struck me for some reason in this commentary that he was writing about Dogen. He says, "You should make a determined effort. You don't have to do anything for the nation or for our school." Speaking of the Soto school. "As long as you endeavor, you will naturally become a person. Although we can't promise beforehand." I just think that this little passage, it just really spoke to me a lot. Even though, you know, in it he's not unpacking some particularly naughty passage of Dogen, or it's not a profound philosophical insight, maybe we could say. But there's a lot there. And so he begins by saying, you should make a determined effort. So we're engaged in this determined effort this morning. For those of us who are sitting all morning, maybe we would consider that it takes a little bit more determined effort. But each one of us made a determined effort to get up and get dressed and get in the car or to the train or walk here. And then maybe we sat one period. That really is quite an extraordinary, if we look at the spectrum of activities that the, 8 million people in the city are engaged in this morning, we could say that this maybe this activity takes a particular sort of determination. But then he says, right afterwards, you should make a determined effort, but you don't have to do anything for the nation or for our school. I liked this sentiment. Sometimes we do have to do something for the nation, but often that thing for the nation just starts by just finding your place where you are. So Tigan, our teacher, he's going to be traveling soon to Washington to protest. Isn't that funny? I can't remember what he's protesting.
the Bill McKibben thing that has to do with decisions that were being made with the Keystone Pipeline.
Right. Yeah, very important. So these kinds of activities, it's something I really appreciate about our teacher and about practicing in our time and place. Because maybe in the 19th century, when he's saying these things, there's not real sense in Japan in the 19th century about social activism. This is something particularly maybe Western or American. That's something I really appreciate about, well, our time and place, that we have some agency as participants in a democratic society. We have agency. We can go protest. But I think that, I know as a young man, I was very involved in activism, and I worked for Greenpeace, I worked for Amnesty International, and I protested, and I got sprayed with hoses in people's lawns trying to tell them that they should oppose whaling and nuclear power. And I got arrested, you know, protesting. So, but I hadn't found practice at that time, and I got very burnt out. And I think if we look at our world today, it's very easy to become, to have that feeling of being overwhelmed by the enormity of the difficulties that we face as a species, much less as individuals. You know, I personally having difficulties with my job right now. So we have these personal difficulties, all of us, everybody in here has some personal difficulty that you're confronting right now. But then we have these larger issues too. So, Nishiari says we have to make a determined effort. And I think we all understand that. But there's this, there's this relieving statement. You don't have to do anything for the nation or for our school. So we don't have to try really, really hard with missionary zeal, evangelical fervor. We don't have to go out on the street and, you know, try and get people, drag them in and put them on the cushion. We know that. We understand that. And yet, we have to make this determined effort. And so what is that determined effort? Well, it's just showing up when the bell rings, as we say in our tradition. When the han gets hit, you go to your cushion. When the bell rings, you get up. When the food shows up, you eat it. And you bow in gratitude. This is, it's finding the right place, finding your place and what's necessary. And sometimes it's necessary to drive across the country and protest. If you have the means and the opportunity, and there's a necessity for that. And to just, like Tigan has talked about, you know, with his activism, just with like, you know, Nyozan was very involved too with the Occupy activities going on last year. going down and just sitting and holding a space of kind of silence in the midst of all of this determined effort. And that's really what we're doing. If we do think about the complexion of this entire city that's occurring around us, and the nation around that, and the globe around that, to just come here and find your place on your cushion, I think you can start to get a flavor of how transformative and important that can be. Nishiyari says, as long as you endeavor, you will naturally become a person. So becoming a person, I like this phrase a lot. It seems like maybe this is one of our most important endeavors. And I think I like our practice because we don't have this determination to some program in order to become a better person, whatever that might look like. He doesn't say become a better person. Just to become a person. I think that that's what our practice gives us an opportunity to experience and cultivate a little bit. That's the thing I appreciate about it, is that I just get to come, and this just feels like a very natural human activity in this process of becoming a person. Sometimes the word cultivation gets used, and I like that word a lot too. We're cultivating something, like in a garden, or maybe it's more like Nyozan again has worked with trees. He's becoming familiar with trees, orchards, and sometimes trees need pruning, they need fertilizer. But they do their own thing according to their conditions. They can be shaped in many different ways. I live near a series of large parks. They're long parks along the river, the Chicago River, just a little northwest of here. And I love looking at all the trees and how they've each responded to their conditions and their places. And some have thrived and some aren't doing so well. And then periodically somebody comes through and endeavors with determined effort to shape them and help them and help them to thrive. So, as long as you endeavor, you will naturally become a person. But then he says, although we can't promise beforehand. But we sort of can promise, I think, also, you know, that even before any sort of cultivation or even before showing up, you already are who and what you are. So one of my heroes, Thelonious Monk, said everybody's a genius at being themselves. I think that that's a wonderful sentiment. And Suzuki Roshi said, we're all perfect as we are, and we could use a little improvement. So it's that same idea, and that leads me to the underlying topic that I've sort of been reflecting on related to this quote, which is this teaching in our school of suchness, in the Buddhist tradition of suchness. And Taigen's been touching on this a little bit lately, too. So there are two aspects, it seems to me, two main aspects to our Zen teaching. And those two things are often called emptiness, shunyata, and suchness, or tatata, shunyata and tatata, sometimes called dharmata. And tat-tata is often translated as suchness. And these two things are just really like our two hands pressed together in, you know, gassho, in our sign of respect. You know, they're seemingly separate, and yet if we just trace them back to their roots, we see that they're actually coming off of the same body. They're not really separate at all. We can't have one without the other. But they really help balance, because we have tendencies to become unbalanced as these endeavoring human beings. We have a tendency to become unbalanced. So sometimes we get our minds become caught by emptiness, or maybe we just need to cultivate an understanding of emptiness. So emptiness is really this realization that this morning it struck me that there are two wonderful teachings from our founder Suzuki Shinryu, Shogaku Shinryu Suzuki, who we call Suzuki Roshi out of respect. And he had two really great one-liners that really sum up these teachings of emptiness and suchness. And he was once asked, what is the essence of Buddha Dharma? The standard kind of Zen question. What is the essence of Buddhism? Or Zen. And he said, not always so. That's emptiness. It's a wonderful encapsulation of the teaching of emptiness. Not always so. I don't even feel like I need to say anything else about it. And then at another time, he talked about sort of encapsulating this teaching of suchness and the teaching of Jiju Zammai that we'll be chanting later as things as it is. That's kind of a really nice way to describe suchness, I think. So this was his Japanese-English. But there's something very... I studied with a Korean teacher for many years, and many of his kind of strange Korean-English phrases actually were better at giving the flavor of something than maybe if he'd described it more accurately, grammatically. So things as it is, not things as they are, but this sense that it does something in your brain that's kind of nice. Things as it is. So you'll hear Taigen sometimes say that. He slips it in to his talks. Things as it is. So when we come, we endeavor to come with our determined effort, and we show up on our cushion, and we just experience things as it is. So this entire phenomenological happening that we're engaged in, that we're experiencing, and that includes, well, in the Buddhist tradition, they call them skandhas, piles of activity. So we have an energetic level, we have this physical level, we hear, we smell, we feel hot or cold. There are all these levels of activity that are going on. And that whole thing together is things as it is. And Zazen and our other forms give us this wonderful opportunity to just plug in and just experience things as it is without a lot of extra, trying to maybe peel away some of the extra stuff so that we can actually get a little bit of a taste of this thing called tatata, suchness. So the Zen tradition I like often resorts to poetry, poetic imagery, because this is true in our Western tradition too. You know, this is why poetry exists, and music and art and of all sorts. Just like this room, which is quite artfully has been quite artfully arranged for us, it gives us that sense of suchness. It is designed to help us access that quality. Some quality. And that, you know, we could look at the Japanese tradition and all these arts of flower arranging, tea ceremony, haiku poetry, on and on and on. These are all this understanding of the Japanese, of Asian culture in many respects. We have our own gifts here, but there are these gifts that we're experiencing and appreciating from Asia. And a lot of it has to do with their having tuned in to this idea, this experience of suchness, things as it is, and the richness and the beauty and the goodness, the fundamental basic goodness of things as it is. But we can't access that sensation, that goodness of things as it is, if we don't recognize emptiness. So these are how, this is how we get balanced. So if we get too kind of caught up with things as it is, we need the teaching of not always so. But if we get too caught up with not always so, maybe we know how that manifests in your life. I can think of how it manifests in my life at times when I've been too caught up with not always so. It can be hard to get some traction. Maybe you fall into nihilism or depression or, you know, we can become unbalanced in that way. But if we get too caught up with things as it is, maybe we're too gung-ho or something, you know. And maybe we experience it right on our cushion, in our posture. Maybe we're leaning back, maybe we're slumped. Maybe we're leaning forward, we're leaning into it too hard. I don't know. Maybe that's a possibility. I think, you know, there's no prescription. It's just our practice is an investigation. We show up with some kind of determined posture and we just investigate our experience, our own experience, which is, you know, what Nishiari is talking about here. Trying to naturally become a person, which is really ironic because the more you would try, the more you might fall away from it. But if we just show up when the bell rings, engage in the practice, as Suzuki Roshi also said, it's like becoming wet in a mist. You don't realize it, but slowly, imperceptibly, you start to become a real person. Hopefully. But we can't make any promises. So I found another quote. It's kind of speaking about Asian aesthetics that I sort of liked. It's from Bruce Lee. So maybe some of you know Bruce Lee. I loved Bruce Lee when I was a kid. I think, you know, my introduction to Zen was Bruce Lee and Kung Fu, the TV show. I loved both. And I had big posters of Bruce Lee in my bedroom and had lots of nunchucks that I hit myself in the head with regularly, trying to be Bruce Lee. My dad liked to remind me about how he found me on the floor in the living room once, kind of on my hands and knees, with a big lump in the middle of my forehead. I just whacked myself with my nunchucks really hard. Bruce Lee I was not, so I chose the safer path of Zazen. But he wrote, I guess his widow, Linda Lee, who never remarried after his very early demise. But she, I guess, recently released a letter that he had written her early in their relationship. And it's kind of circulating on the internet. And I just saw it for the first time on Facebook, I think. Nathan, who's our Facebook master, he probably knows this already, but maybe some of you do too. But I just really, there's some really nice sentiments here. And he wrote to her, "To live content with small means, to seek elegance rather than luxury, and refinement rather than fashion, to be worthy, not respectable, and wealthy, not rich, to study hard, think quietly, talk gently, act frankly, to bear all cheerfully, do all bravely, await occasions, hurry never." In other words, to let the spiritual unbidden and unconscious grow up through the common. This is a very profound teaching. He was a very young man at this point, so. But I think this what he's saying here is almost like a flower, a flowering of a lot of these ideas that are just, you know, so fundamental in Chinese, you know, our tradition, or our Zen tradition, originally in India, but really Zen as we understand it is a flower of the encounter of Indian Buddhism with Chinese kind of Taoism, maybe Confucianism, these different strains coming together. But as, you know, Nishiyari is talking about naturally becoming a person, and I think Bruce Lee's talking about what some of the symptoms of that look like. I like this word, elegance. But he contrasts it with luxury. This is something we don't understand in our culture at this time, but it's so rooted in who we are as Americans, too. We understood this throughout much of our history. Elegance rather than luxury. You know, I think some Americans along the way have been quite elegant. I think of someone like Thoreau. You know, I think he's a very elegant thinker, but he certainly wasn't into luxury. Refinement rather than fashion. I think that this is something about in our practice. Wealthy but not rich. So, study hard, think quietly. Think quietly. Talk gently, act frankly. Await occasions. Await occasions. And let the spiritual, which is a tricky word, but I like the other ones he uses, unbidden and unconscious, grow up through the common. So that's what we're doing in our sitting. Is we're just allowing the weeds to grow and the plants, allowing everything to just grow up, and then we can see it. And then maybe we do some cultivating. Once we see it, we can do some pruning. We can do some adjusting in our posture. We realize in this container, maybe we can see how we're distracted, or maybe we see that we're walking too hard, or we notice that the person ahead of us during walking meditation has moved away too far, so we have to take a couple extra steps to stay in harmony. This is how we become people. I feel like I should assign myself a timekeeper. Is that, what time am I supposed to go to?
What time do you want to go to? Maybe 11 or so.
I think I'm getting close to.
I believe schedule, I think, says 11 or after DT.
Good. Thank you. I need all the help I can get.
You want comments? Is there time for comments?
Yeah, we'll We'll definitely leave time for comments. So I want to... I think that's basically what I had to say. But just to tie it into this idea of Jiju Zanmai, just a little bit, because Jiju Zanmai is a short text, but it's a long chant. We're going to chant it today. But Jiju Zanmai is this activity. What it means, how it's translated by another Japanese teacher that I like a lot. He calls it the self living out the self as the self. So that's what we do when we come in and we sit. We in this activity of endeavoring to become a person, we just are allowing the self to act out the self as the self, that it's already actualizing itself. The self is already taking care of the self. If we just show up, the symptoms may look like elegance and maybe look like patience in time. You know, maybe we become more patient. Maybe we become more... Well, some of the list of things Bruce Lee was talking about. Maybe those things happen. But it's a little bit different than a self-help program. So we just show up and we allow the power of this sitting practice to permeate us, and for us to permeate it, and for us to permeate each other and help each other become natural people. So this is a really rare and precious opportunity. I just feel that every time I come to Ancient Dragon. I'm just very thankful. So I'm very thankful that you all showed up this morning and that we get this chance to sit together and become natural people. So thank you. So maybe somebody has some comments. Yes, there's one.
I thought that was a very rich talk in lots of ways. And, the different parts relate to each other in very interesting ways. You were talking about the sort of relationship of the 10,000 things and suchness to emptiness, particular to the more general. You also spoke about use the metaphor of walking around the zendo and how we adjust that part of truly becoming a person. The very person, not somebody else, but the very person that you are, has to do with, seeing how that arises in, co-arises with others. That ties in very interestingly, I think, to, this sort of earlier that you had about Nishiari Bokusan and your comments about Taigen. I think it's these Jewel Mir Samadhi uses a line, failure to serve is not filial. And, they're putting, so it's as I understand it, it's asking people to see, what their responsibilities, what their duties are, in relationship to each other, but the context at that time was feudalism, so it was all sort of in that language. But, what is it to serve, in relationship to other people in order to become truly yourself in a, at least putatively, democratic society? Sometimes, it may mean different things for different people, but certainly sometimes it can mean engaging as a citizen, engaging democratically as a citizen. Just thinking further, about, Nishiri Bokusan's comment about, you don't have to serve the country. I wonder if part of the context for that is, you know, that he was speaking in a time of Japanese history when Buddhist institutions were sort of self-consciously sort of because they'd been persecuted, sort of recreating themselves as servants of the state, which was a, you know, sort of misguided effort in many ways. And then just finally, one more comment. I think you said that sort of Buddhist engagement was sort of peculiarly American. And I think it has peculiarly American forms, but you know, I think it's important for people to, in sort of maybe evaluating the legitimacy of that, to realize that it's actually part of a very wide phenomenon. You know, people are doing things in Burma, the monks in Burma, Thich Nhat Hanh in Vietnam, the nuns in Taiwan. So,
yeah, I think that those are great comments. Thank you, Nozan. And the thing that strikes me is the tradition was founded, you know, the historical Buddha, Gautama, did not advocate becoming hermits in caves. He created, really, his direction was in his time and place. It had particular forms associated with it, but really to create an enlightened society. That began with creating a sangha of monks and then nuns, but those monks and nuns were never removed from society. They were always a part of society as a transformative agent. But where did the transformation begin? It began on the cushion. So, yeah, you know, there's never, you know, I think these things, they have different manifestations at different times, our delusions and our enlightened impulses. They have different, maybe they look differently at different times, but I think, as long as I think about this, you don't have to do anything for the nation or for our school. I think there's plenty of manifestations in our society now of people who were, I watched a really wonderful documentary last night on Sarah Palin, made by a British filmmaker. So we could kind of think of manifestations in our society of people who maybe overemphasize what we could call patriotism, nationalism. But that was certainly true in 19th century Japan. So maybe he was speaking to that. But it's also just very human, you know, it's like a very human way to become unbalanced, to get too caught up in conditions outside the self. I often think of Ramana Maharshi. So Gandhi used to send some of his activists to go study with this great non-dual hermit sage almost. I mean, he just lived in this mountain and never left it, Arunachala. And then they would go and they would get their batteries recharged and they'd get kind of rebalanced and then they could go back and do activism. To forge a nation. So that balance, you know, the balance. Are we balanced? We have to know for ourselves. Only we can know. And maybe it's time for you to get off your cushion and go protest. Go join Taigen. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, Roy.
Yeah, when you were reading that section about, you know, you don't have to do anything for the nation or for the school, it sort of reminded me that sentiment that you'll hear sometimes, don't do me any favors. Like that, you know, that feeling like sometimes you'll be around somebody and they're doing things for you, but there's always strings and hooks and attachments and just all kinds of karma around it. And it actually reminded me of, I went out to hear some musicians with a friend. And we had our coats, and she had a purse, and we put them down, and then, you know, we were going out and dancing and stuff, but, and she kind of wandered off. And there were all these, there were our coats and her purse. And so I was watching it, you know, and she goes, I have no idea where she is, and I'm just standing there like a doofus watching the coats as, you know, she's doing all of her stuff. And this brought back all kinds of my own personal issues that I won't get into. But, you know, when... So I grab up everything, and I eventually find her, and I'm pissy as hell with her. And she's like, what's the matter? And I said, you know, you left me to watch all this stuff. She's like, I didn't need you to watch that stuff. I didn't care. That was your issue, not mine. In other words, don't do me any favors. And I think sometimes we get so caught up, we think we're doing everybody a favor and doing all this stuff. And there was nothing wrong with me grabbing coats. It was the attitude I brought to it. And I think sometimes we do this practice and we think we're doing the world such a great favor. No, we aren't. You know, if we go out and, you know, stop the, you know, the oil shale from, you know, whatever, if we save the environment, we aren't doing anybody any favors. We really aren't. I think we have to get back to just, we do it because it's our practice, because we're a person. Not because the world owes us or we're getting some kind of credits. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it makes great sense. And I think, I mean, that's the wonder of this practice, is that it teaches you, I mean, it shows you when you're, you know, you can feel all gung-ho one period of zazen, and the next one you're in hell, you know. So you can feel great in the one, you can feel terrible for the first 15 minutes and then feel great for the next 15 minutes. Or your practice feels really generous and you just feel really expansive for one period of walking meditation, and then, you know, by the next period of walking meditation, you know, you're completely caught up in some kind of rage against your enemies. And, you know, it's the practice just shows you our limited nature and how we just can't micromanage this stuff. But we keep, you know, this is the power of vow. Someone here recently was really pointed to this, and maybe it was you, Roy, I don't know. But the power of vow, and I think about it often, we just establish a direction and we just keep going. So we just keep showing up. It's nice to show up once, and for those of you who are coming for the first time, maybe you don't come back, and that's great. That's fine. But then there's another side of it.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, I don't mean it that way. I just don't want to be high pressure, like you must, you know, I don't want to be evangelical about practice. You are more than welcome, veritably encouraged to return often. But, you know, for those of us who've, like, taken on the whole enchilada, you know, you just to show up, you start to realize more and more it's just enough to show up. I'm sure Nyozan is feeling that way this morning.
Yeah. I ran out of gas, so I'm like short drive. I apologize for being late.
No way. So that was a huge endeavor and effort that he made, and that was enough. He can just relax now. Yeah. Any other one last comment?
Yeah. Oh, I just really wanted to comment on you used the word care, and I think a lot about the word care, and because I get struck by the various ways in which people use the word care. And we think about, you know, like, I don't care about that. It's, you know, it seems like it starts with a thought or an idea about, you know, whether or not something is worthy of our attention, and maybe it comes with a sentiment of love or some other kind of, like, oh, I care about that. But then it was actually when you were talking about trees where I remembered that there's some tree surgeon's truck who drives around and it says, you know, whatever, it's a bad advertisement because I can't remember his name, but it's for the care of trees is his slogan. And I love the word care in that context because I think it pertains to what you're talking about with zazen, that we, and becoming a person, you know, we have an idea that, you know, we care in some way, and then we feel some care. And then to really care, though, is to become very familiar with what that thing or whatever it is, what that aspect of life or the world needs, and what we maybe have to bring to it. And so, what, you know, I think it's such a nice, the word itself, thinking about it for me, is such a nice antidote to, you know, being sort of a good Zen student where, you know, you sort of like,
you can learn all the rules and do all the things you're supposed to be doing. And in some ways, you know, there's a feeling of maybe we become a cookie cutter kind of Zen student. But you're saying, you know, you become a person, and each one of us becomes a different person because of how we maybe manifest some of that care. Whether and it starts, you know, the things that we care about, I think, are going to be different. You know, and so then, and then the things that we then care in the means of cultivation will certainly be different. So I really appreciated that sort of came up.
Yeah, just to care, you know.
Yeah.
And when you don't care, just to notice that you don't care. That's all, you know. That's all. That's our effort. Mm-hmm. Just to notice what we notice. I teach art, and our major pedagogical tool is called critique. So maybe some of you have had this in our class. I mean, you make something, it goes on the wall or on the table or whatever, and then everybody talks about it. But I just realized at a certain point, you know, how do you start that off? I mean, most people say, okay, what do you think? What do you think about that? It's just a killer. Mm-hmm. Such a bad recipe for a discussion. So I say, what do you notice? Just to get these, often it's difficult to get them talking. So I just say, what do you notice that you notice? Mm-hmm. Notice what you notice. That's a much, and then they can go, oh, it's blue, it's round, it's big, it's small, it's hot, it's cold, whatever. That's a much better place to start. So, you know, we'll leave it at that. You know, I encourage you, if you're staying, to just continue to notice what is coming into attention without judgment, or, you know, you don't need to manipulate it or change it or do anything with it. Just notice it. And if you're leaving, just, you know, continue maybe that thread of just noticing what you notice through the day today. So thank you all for great comments and for coming today.